You're listening to Trucking Questions from the Audio Road with Kevin Rutherford. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. You can ask questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, tax, technology, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the Audio Road.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, really the thing at all, pick up the phone, give me a call. I'll do my best to get you an answer. If I can't answer it, many times somebody listening can help us out. And we're, we're going to jump right into the phone calls tonight and see how many people we can help out. Let's start off in Texas. Sean, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. I had a couple questions for you. One
sure.
of them is I'm going to swap out all my batteries and get some deep cycle batteries installed. And then later I'm going to put a ESM on it, but I have to get batteries now. So what I want to do is run four batteries plus an ESM. So if I ever sell my truck, which I'm planning on doing in the next couple of years, I can just pull off that ESM and just put it on my next truck. My question to you is, I want to put a solar-powered triple charger because every week in my truck sits for about 60 hours, and I want to run my
okay.
refrigerator. How many watts of a triple charger should I get to maintain this battery?
Here's the thing. When it comes to solar, and I've been playing around with this, more is always better. It solar is still pretty weak, really. It depends so much on the condition. In the summertime, full sun, chargers will do great. Like I have two really, well, not really big. I have two good size panels on the top of my RV, bigger than you would be able to put on a tractor. And in the summertime, keeps all four of my batteries topped right off. In the wintertime, nothing. Even on sunny days in the wintertime, the batteries just get lower and lower and lower every day. There's so
That's
little charge going in. Yeah, so it really comes down to as much surface as you can get on that truck and as much charging power as you could get. I would maximize either what you can afford or what you can fit.
Okay, well, I'm probably going to get a stick-on panel. Like you told me about Enel last year, and I know they're offering systems now. So I'm probably going to get like a 60-watt panel just so I can overkill it. Because my intention, I have an APU. But I don't like to use it.
Yeah.
I run Texas only. So there's about 100 nights out of the year that I need AC. So I'm actually going to put a portable air conditioner in this truck, run that off the batteries as much as I can. I have my APU as backup as well as my ESM. So, and last question, when I heard on your show, you have Bruce on over the weekend, and I almost fell out of my truck when he mentioned he's going to have a power box for the DD15. Do you know anything more about that?
He told me the first day that they hooked it up to a DD15 and they were able to build on the dyno and measure the output. So, I'll be seeing him this week and I'll check more on that. And I know they've got, some more production they've got to get through. I don't know if they've done the EPA testing on it yet. But once they get that close, things usually move pretty quick.
Well, if he needs a beta tester, I'll sign up right now.
Well, you know what? It never hurts.
Yep, I will.
Yeah, it never hurts. Give him a call and let him know you're interested. And again, on the solar, my experience right now is there is no such thing as overkill. It's the opposite. It reminds me of the first 15 years I was using computers. You could never get enough hard drive space. You could buy the most expensive hard drive on the market. You could never get enough. Now we finally got past that. But solar for me right now, it's just a matter of space and money. If I could afford more, I'd put more. If I had room for more, I'd put more. you just, in my opinion, you just can't get enough. So there's virtually no danger of overkill. Let's go to New Mexico. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you doing today? I've got a couple of questions for you. First one, I've got my ASMIT and everything's ready. I just got a little bit of paperwork to fill out for Landstar, and we can go there. Now, question regarding that is, should I keep my own license, my own license plates at IFTA, or should I use theirs?
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. I prefer, and people have different opinions about this. I prefer that if I'm with a carrier that I trust and a carrier, and couldn't be with a carrier if I didn't trust them, and if I think I'm going there a while, and again, I wouldn't be at a carrier if I didn't think I was going to be there a while, I prefer to let them handle things that they'll handle. It's one less thing I have to do. So it frees me up to do the things that are more important, run my business, learn new things, work on my health, whatever it might be, spend more time with my family. So there are some people who say, no, I don't want them handling that, because if I want to leave here, I just want to pull out and go, and I want my own stuff. So there's no right answer. It's what you're comfortable with. For me, if somebody else will do it, and especially if they'll do it and it doesn't cost me anything, you know, they'll handle the paperwork. They go get my plates. They'll do my fuel tax. As long as they're doing my fuel tax right, and I'm getting the right deal, and they'll do all that stuff, insurance, take it out of my settlement, do all that stuff for me. It just frees my time up for more important things, family, health, business, money, whatever. So that's the way I like to do it. Some people say they don't want that. They want to know they have their own base plate, their own insurance, all that stuff. But those are really the issues. Do you want to be, you know, independent enough that if you decided to quit, you could drive off the lot and never have to worry about it? Or would you rather have them take care of stuff and you don't have to worry about it?
Well, that's true. And, well, then that means April 1st, he's putting this thing down, but we're ready to go on with him, and that should be a week or so. Got some other things to do. And the second question I have for you, this is M14 Cummins, 97 Freightliner. Here lately, it's been a lot harder starting in the morning. I mean, I have to crank it a little bit more to get it to start, which in the warm weather doesn't make sense. And it seems like it runs kind of rough for a few minutes. Then when I release the brakes and I step on the gas, it's like chugging for the first couple of seconds till I step on the gas, and then it seems to smooth out.
I lost you on that last sentence there. I heard it was an N14 and all that, but I didn't get the problem. You were breaking up. Say that again.
Well, when I start the engine in the morning, or really any time, it runs kind of rough for the first few minutes. And then when I step on the, I take it off high idle on the throttle, and I step on the gas myself, it seems like it kind of runs rough for a few seconds till it smooths out. And it does the same thing when I release the parking brake and I put it in gear to roll out in the morning. The first, maybe 50 or 100 feet, it's running kind of rough.
When this is happening, are you noticing any black smoke, white smoke, gray smoke, anything at all?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so are you doing oil samples?
Yes, I am.
Are we getting any indication of fuel dilution, heavy soot, or possible coolant?
We haven't been, and my coolant level is good now. This is the first time, but I chalked it up to being about 3,000 overdue for an oil change. So I just had to dump a gallon in here this morning, and that's the first time that's happened to this thing since before when I had a leak.
Right. Okay. So that shouldn't be a big issue. Check your oil samples real close. because that'll give us a clue. Have you been in one of those areas? Like, I was just out in the Pacific, or in the southwest part of the country, and the days were about 70 degrees and the nights were about 20 degrees. Big, big temperature swings throughout, you know, in just a 24-hour period. Have you been in areas like that?
This is where I've been for the last month.
Okay. And that's an explanation, because here's why. When you get big temperature swings like that, we get condensation built up inside the cylinders. And that condensation is just like having water in your fuel, but you burn it out pretty quick. And it sounds like that's what's going on. You know, you got a real hot day, maybe a little bit of humidity, you get some moisture buildup, gets really cold that night, the moisture condenses, it's sitting in the cylinder, and you've got to burn it out when you start up the engine. So that's probably a good explanation of what's going on. I wouldn't worry about it too much. But again, the oil samples will be our first clue if something is going wrong. So pay attention to those. Let's get to a break. I'll come right back and get to some more calls. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's go to Billings, Montana. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Love your show.
Thank you.
I got two questions for you, and you know, for your an opinion from me, I should say. I'm looking at buying a new trailer, and I want to do some aerodynamics on it. Of course, I'm going to put the under tray on for sure, but I want to know the difference between the top kit on the Smart Truck system and why don't they go all the way down on the side, and what's your opinion between that product and the air tabs on the back of the trailer?
Good questions. And one of the things that I'm actually looking to do, and maybe even looking to Smart Truck to help me out with, is to do some testing with both. And putting the air tabs just forward of the top kit. Air tabs has some information that leads me to believe we might get a double benefit by doing that. And if not, I've used the air tabs for years and love them. We know they work. We know we get results. The top kit works. We know we get results. We've got tested results. So there are two great options. It's one of those that I don't really have a favorite. I like both of them. They're both working. And now see if maybe we could combine them and get an even bigger benefit, because they're both pretty inexpensive. So yeah, we're going to play around with that, you know, this year sometime. The reason it doesn't come all the way down, and this is interesting. When I started researching trailer aerodynamics and I started talking to companies that made fairings and side skirts and all the different options, what I found was most of the companies doing skirts had virtually no testing, nothing scientific. You know, they said, okay, here, we'll throw some skirts on here. We'll sell some. We'll get some testimonials. People will tell us how they're doing. And that was about it. It was kind of scary, really. And then you would see a little tweak here and there. They used to go straight down, then they brought some in. But I would ask people, why are you doing it that? Well, you know, we think it's going to work better. And then when I got to Smart Truck, I walked into their facility and I was just in awe. I found trucks with like 1,000 sensors all over them that were running out on the road every day. They were working with companies like FedEx and Frito-Lay and some of the local companies, and they outfitted these trucks with thousands of sensors and computers, and they were literally testing every single day. I walked into their computer lab and saw all their lab simulation stuff that they were doing. They were renting outrageously expensive computer time at one of the universities because they have this giant supercomputer that is the only one in the country that can do the kind of simulations they were doing. And it was just amazing to see the amount of testing and research they were doing. It totally blew me away, way more than anybody else I found. And that was one of the reasons I chose to partner with them. Because they're doing that kind of testing, they are literally able to get things down to saying, okay, if we move this 1 inch in this direction, we get a slightly better result. If we make this 3/4 of an inch wider, we get better results. And what they found on that top kit, because I asked the same question, they found that that was the limit of results. If you went any further down on the trailer, it changed nothing at all. So they said, why build it any bigger than we need to? This is the limit. If we go just an inch bigger, we get no results. If we go 3 feet bigger, we don't get any results. So that's what impresses me so much about them. They are really fine-tuning and tweaking this stuff with real research, science, and testing.
Yep. So that answers my other question. And if you put air tabs below the smart trucks extensions, would that make a difference? But if they did all the research, I guess I don't have to.
Exactly. And one of the things they found was for some reason down at the bottom of the trailer, either their system or the air tabs didn't come out far enough from the trailer to catch the airstream down there. And you had to come out too far and to get any kind of results. And then you've got width issues and all kinds of things that they just couldn't do. So I was just, like I said, I was so impressed by those kind of results that we've just never seen that kind of information before.
That's amazing. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Arizona. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call, Kevin. I've been doing my own taxes using TurboTax for years. Been trucking for a little over 2 years. The first year, there wasn't much to write off against with all the startup expenses.
Right.
The past year, I'm profitable. So I put the DOT time on the road, the $59 a day,
right,
amounted to $12,800 and a change. And it calculated automatically 80% of that, but that reduced the liability, tax liability, only by about $1,070. Does that sound right to you?
No, it doesn't. One of the things you can do, because if was the 12,000 the 80%, or was the 12,000 the total amount?
12,800 was the total amount.
Okay, so if we adjust that by 20% down, that means it's about 2,400 off of that. So let's just round it and say you were about a $9,000 deduction. And if it's being done right, it should. Now, you're an owner-operator, right?
Yes.
Now, it should adjust your total liability by about $3,000, by about 30% of the total write-off. Now, are you putting that number on the Schedule C, or are you putting it on the Schedule A?
No, I'm Schedule A.
That's your mistake.
I did a W-2 for myself.
No. That, okay. Boy, am I glad you called. We're going to fix you right up.
Okay.
Okay, get rid of those W-2s. You can't do that. You are a sole proprietor, and you can't pay yourself.
But I'm a corporation, Kevin.
Let's take a step back. All right, let's take a step back.
Okay.
Let me think this through. Who's doing your corporate return?
I do it.
I might recommend you have somebody else do it. No, and look, okay. I love when people try this. I really do. And here's what I would actually recommend. I would recommend that this year you get somebody to do your corporation, but find somebody that will let you work with them and will actually show you how to do it. Because I'm not saying you can't do it. In fact, I'm sure you can. But there are some tricky parts in there and some decisions that need to be made, and a different couple of different ways we could calculate this. Like we could, I'm thinking that you might be better off to show the per diem as a corporate expense, because as an employee expense, you're seeing it just doesn't help enough. But on the corporate side, you'd be able to get a much bigger deduction, which would mean there would be less money flowing to you personally. But in order to get the best deduction, you really have to play around with both tax returns. You've got to say, okay, let's try it this way, and then run through all the numbers, and then go back and say, no, let's try it this way and run through all the numbers. And like I say, I think you could do this, but I even did this. If I go way back to when I wanted to get into, you know, doing owner operator accounting and tax returns, the first year I did all the accounting, but I hired an accountant to work with me, and she did all the tax, but I worked with her on every one. And before I would send it to her, I would do it myself, and I would wait for hers to come back, and I would compare the two. And then I would ask her, hey, why did you do it this way? And, you know, I did that for a year. And then the next year, I was doing tax returns on my own. And I think you could do the same thing. But I think that this year with an S-Corp and a personal return, there's some issues here that I don't want you to miss out on. So I would hire somebody and then just work with them.
And I appreciate that. I thought that it didn't sound right. And before hiring someone, I just wanted to ask you about that, given your background in accounting.
Yeah, and even that tells me that you get this. You know, you knew when you saw that, this doesn't sound right. And that just tells me you understand what's going on. You just need help with a couple issues that are a little complicated, really. And you'll be off and running doing this on your own next year.
Great. I'll seek help on that. And if I have another question, if I may.
Sure.
I have an ISX EGR coupled to a 10-speed Eaton. And it's 400 horsepower, and there's a shop in town that says they can raise it to 550. And I'm just not sure about the benefit. How is it going to affect MPG? Is there a real benefit from it?
Got it. We're coming up on a break. Let me put you on hold, and we'll come back and talk about that. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. You know, if you need any help from us at all, you can find a lot of stuff on our website. If you're looking for any of the products we talk about here on the air, whether it's our fuel gauges, profit gauges, the programs I write to help you in the business, and even some of the partner products we talk about, we keep adding things to our online store, making them easier for you to find. You can get OPS, the OPS supplies, oil samples, the Maxwell Start module, just the list goes on and on. We're adding to it all the time. So check that out at letstruck.com. And anytime you have a question, just give us a call. We have a Tribe Care team here that would love to help you. 855-800-FUEL. 855-800-3835. We're going to get back to the calls. I was talking with Robert in Arizona. Robert, you know, here's the thing. We've found over the years that 400 horsepower is definitely on the low side, and it actually hurts fuel economy depending on your operation. So, for example, in my operation running Florida and Georgia only with some of my trucks and being fairly light most of the time, I could run my horsepower down as low as 350, 375 and get better fuel economy. But when I had trucks that ran heavier and got out west and had to pull more and deal with, you know, more wind and things like that, that 500 to 550 actually improved fuel economy as long as you were driving it right. You know, if you were using the horsepower to race everybody up the hill, it could hurt fuel economy, but if you use the horsepower to help you get up the hill without the engine working so hard, you know, downshifting a little earlier, keeping the RPMs up, keeping the boost low, then we could actually improve fuel economy. Now, there's one other thing I have to say. There are a lot of shops out there, and I can't possibly know them all. And when somebody used to do something mechanical to an engine, we could see it. And we know what they did. But when people start messing around with ECMs, we can't see it. And there are, Bruce just said this the other day, like over 6,000 settings in an ISX that can be changed. And you start thinking about all the possible combinations. If there are 6,000 settings, it's in the millions. That's insane. So not every way of turning up horsepower is good. I know people who are screwing around with timing, screwing around with injector settings, you know, that produce results as far as horsepower, throttle response, but it can also do damage to an engine. I mean, we can create a lot of heat. We can create lousy timing that's hard on the pistons, and we can actually...
That was my concern. That was my exact concern. I'm coming up onto a million miles and not burning any oil. Everything runs just fine. It's, you know, fine-tuned after 2 years working on it. And I don't want to hurt the engine by just raising the horsepower.
Yeah, if it's done right, it will actually extend the life of the engine. Just like it can help fuel economy, it can actually extend the life of the engine by allowing the engine to not work quite as hard all the time. But it has to be done right. And there's no way for me to say this is the only way to do it right. I just have to try to advise people to work with shops that you trust. You know, I've seen some crazy things out there. And this is one example. There's a guy in around the Effingham, Illinois area called the Diesel Doc. And he's been around for years. And I had looked at his stuff. And he was doing a nice job. He knew what he was doing. He was explaining to people what he was doing. Then all of a sudden, somebody called me and said, hey, I had my engine done at the Diesel Dock and I'm having these problems. And we got it into one of our shops and looked at it, and it was a mess. Not only was the programming a mess, but he had turned off all of the auto shutdowns, all of the safety features on the engine, so that if the oil pressure got too low, it would shut down. If it got too hot, it would shut down. All of that was turned off because of the goofy way he was programming those safety features were getting in his way. He really didn't know what he was doing at all. And he made a mess of that. And I said, wait a minute. I just looked at something this guy did, and it was really good, and this is really bad. This doesn't make sense. Well, then I found out this guy's just running around in a pickup truck in the area calling himself the same name because that guy has a reputation, and people are going, oh, no, I went to the Diesel Dock, and I'm like, I don't think so. Well, it turns out this guy's running around using the name. And he was doing some nasty stuff to the ECM. So you do have to be careful, and you've got to find somebody who you trust. You know, for me, I trust Pittsburgh Power, and there are really very few other places. I mean, I would trust somebody like Fitzgerald to make some changes on the ECM, but they don't really specialize in that kind of stuff. So there just aren't that many places I would trust. It doesn't mean there aren't good ones. And I know people who have a shop they've worked with over the years and they trust them. We also have to make sure they're not doing something that, you know, is going to get us in trouble if we get into a factory authorized shop. So I do like turning up horsepower in the right scenario. I do like some of those ECM settings, but I would be very, very careful about who I let do that. Let's see. Let's go to Barstow. Taylor, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How's your day been? I had some questions about tires. Sure. I got this truck, and obviously since I'm California, well, you know, it's a newer truck. When I got tires on the drives, they're all mismatched recaps. I'm wanting to put a set on. I've always been a fan of wide singles. Back when I pulled flatbed, I had wide singles. Never had a problem. You know, people complain about blowouts. Never had an issue.
Right.
You know, I talked to the shop where I'm leased to right now, and I practically laughed at when I talked about wanting to put wide singles on. But I was looking at Michelin's tire calculator and, you know, putting some of the tires I have on here. As far as, you know, how it has, the new one has the base set of 100, is it every 10 points up you go, that's a tenth of a mile per gallon, or how they got it going on there right now?
Yeah, nothing's really changed. Well, that's not true. They changed it pretty dramatically in one way, meaning that before, you know, the numbers were just all over the board. Now, no matter what you set as your comparison, we always start at 100. That's the big change. But that guideline that I've always put out, 10 points in either direction equals about a tenth of a mile per gallon. So if we increase by 10 points, we're going to lose a tenth. If we decrease by 10 points, we're going to gain a tenth. And that still holds true with the new calculator.
Yeah, some of the tires on here, I see it going up to 153, 117, 179, and that's just no bueno.
It's horrible. Yeah, and I will tell you, a bunch of times, if you're, let's say you're at 100 and you go to 150, you will lose a half mile per gallon every time.
Yeah. And the truck as it is, it's not doing very good on fuel mileage. Our fuel discounts are amazing, but it's a 12-12 ISX 15, 342 ratio with a 13 speed. And I'm looking to try to do what I can to get it up. I have gotten it decent if I drive 60, which sometimes I don't have the time to do it.
The good news is that, you know, sometimes when somebody calls me with a new engine and says, I want to do a fast or a fleet air filter or whatever it might be, if it's engine related, I can't guarantee results because those engines are so fickle. Most of the time we get results, but not always. The thing about rolling resistance, though, it doesn't matter. I don't care if you've got an old mechanical Mac or a brand new 2016, pick any engine you want. Doesn't matter. Rolling resistance is rolling resistance. It's just physics. So the good news is you'll get your results.
I think a lot of the problem right now is the tires, because like I said, they're all mismatched recaps, so I want to get a decent set. Now, let's say if I decided not to go for the X1 line energy Ds, what's the lowest of duals? Because I've been trying to find that, and I haven't really had luck with figuring out what the lowest duals was to compare the two, really.
Last time I looked, and it might not be the absolute lowest, but it was the tire I would still choose overall. And it's the exact same tire instead of X1 line. It's just X line. So it's the dual energy D.
Dual energy X line. All right.
Yeah. So it's going to be a dual tire, not a wide single. So they call it the X line, not the X1 line, but it's still the energy D. And if it's not the absolute lowest, it's going to be close. And then the other benefits of Michelin, you know, are enough to make me pick that tire. It lasts a long time. It's got great traction. It's a real quality tire. Hold that thought. I'm going to get to a break, and I just want to come back and make sure that helped you out. We'll be right back. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, just give me 1 second here. I've got to try to find a ghost in the works here. I'm not sure why it's happening. Oh, all right, I just figured out why it's happening. All right, here we go. We're getting ready to head into the fourth and final segment of the first hour. So at the end of this, I'll say I'm done. I've got to get out of here. Good night. Don't hang up because we're going to come back and do another hour today. So here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us. Well, never mind. We're down to the final segment. So I've got plenty of calls, plenty of questions. I'm just going to get right back to them. You can go to the website, though, if you want. It's letstruck.com. And I'm going to go back to Barstow. Taylor, did that help?
Yeah, as far as drives, I want to ask you about the XDA 3 Plus for the steers. How good are those as far as steer tires go?
There is not another tire I would ever consider right now. That line of tires, I go back 20 plus years using the original XZA1 and then the 1 plus and then over the years they've progressed, and the new XZA3 plus, the Evertread, is just an amazing tire. Great handling, great wear, low rolling resistance, and they just last forever. I've got several people that are around 250,000 miles on that tire now.
Okay. As far as new engines go, what can I do, you know, as far as leader, filter, or I know I can do air tabs, but what else can I do and not get really in trouble with the EPA and whatnot?
Yeah, three things for sure right now. What engine did you say it was? The DD15?
No, ISX.
ISX. Okay,
it's got
so
about
the
306,000 miles on it.
Yeah, the two things that I absolutely know you can do, the fleet air filter and the FAS fuel system, both will help performance and maintenance cost and fuel mileage. You could put the OPS on it and change it out to synthetic, which will improve fuel economy and lower your maintenance cost. And then you could call Pittsburgh Power and see what else they've got, because constantly updating new stuff as they get through their EPA testing. So those for sure you could do. And then if you're still looking for something, I would check back with them.
Okay. I just want to make one last comment. I picked up the tablet recently, the Rand McNally tablet.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. The one problem I have had with it is I hit a bump in the road and it just falls right off the mount. That magnetic mount.
No, the one problem I'm having is not that it falls off the magnetic part, is that it's pretty heavy and I can't keep the suction cup connected to the window. I've tried cleaning it. I'm going to try a new one, but yeah, that's kind of driving me nuts because I love this thing. I mean, I'm using it for everything, but
yeah.
It kind of drives me nuts. I can't keep it attached right.
I prefer it over my 5-inch Garmin. By a long shot, but I'm having the opposite problem as you. My suction cup will stay stuck to the window or the plastic wood dash, you know, that wood plastic wood grain dash. Both of them doesn't fall. But you hit the right bump, it may not even be a big one, falls right off the magnetic mount.
Yeah,
I return it once. Because
I love the magnetic mount. I mean, that is, for me, is just beautiful. But I've got the, Volvo's got the textured kind of dash, so I can't even think about putting... Really, what I'm going to do when I get some time, I'm going to work out a permanent mount on the dash. And what I'm going to do is mount it so that it's resting slightly on the dash itself, so it really won't fall off the magnetic part at all, and the rest of it will be permanently mounted to the dash. Because once I get that part, I like I said, I just love this thing.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the feedback. Let's go to Chicago. Leroy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. What can I help you with today?
Listen, I got a couple questions. First one is I've got a 07 T600 with a C15A cert in it. And about 1,060,000 miles. Now, this truck, it overheats whenever I'm heavy, 40,000 or plus. I'm down in Tennessee, Kentucky, out east, out west. It overheats. And it's been in the shop two or three times. They pressure tested it. One place said it was a biometric sensor. Each time it goes in the shop, it costs me a few $100, and I come out, and I'm still overheating. And about once a month, I can put a gallon and a half or so of antifreeze in there, and I'm at my wit's end. Any suggestions?
Okay. Yeah, I do have some suggestions. I'm not sure I can solve your problem in the first shot, but I've got some ideas to work on. Just give me those numbers again. What year is this, and how many miles?
It's an 07, and I've got 1,060,000 miles.
Got it. So there are a couple things that we've noticed as trucks get older. And this is the reason the shops have such a hard time with this issue. Let me go back so I don't miss this part. If you have to put coolant in a truck, something's wrong. That is a sealed system. And if everything is right, we should never have to put coolant in. So we need to address that, not first, but we need to address it as part of this. Are you doing any oil samples at all?
You know, I've just started doing oil samples. And last service I got at a truck stop, and then I got one at Speedco. So they're not the best oil samples, but both of them came back.
It's not even that if they're the best or not. I can't trust them, period, because I've seen them miss issues exactly like this. We've done enough dual testing where we take one engine, we pull pull one sample, and then we split it into two bottles. So it couldn't be more identical. And we send it to our lab that we've been using for years and years and we trust. And we do an instant read like one of those. And we have seen them absolutely miss completely and be totally wrong. They'll tell us there is a problem when there isn't. They'll tell it there's no problem when there really is. So I can't trust them at all. If you are losing coolant, there's only two options. It's either going outside of the engine or inside of the engine. And our first concern is if it's going inside the engine, it's doing damage. And we want to stop that as soon as possible. So I would recommend you get a full service oil sample. Now, that could still be through a repair shop. I just don't want them to do it on their benchtop and hand you the results right then. I want them to mail it off with a form and tell you, you know, it's going to be a week for your results or whatever it is. You could also use, you know, our lab. You can buy the oil samples right through our website.
On mute return.
Lisa, you know, can help you. But we need to get a full service sample to make sure the coolant isn't going in the engine. Now, that might not have anything at all to do with the overheating. But if you're losing coolant, we need to figure out where and why and get it fixed. That's a different issue. The cooling issue, what we find is as trucks get older, it's not necessarily that anything breaks. It's just that every part of the system starts to get a little worse, and it's enough to cause the truck to overheat. That's why shops have a hard time, because for them, something is either broke or it's not broke. And they look around, they can't find anything broke, they try a couple things, they charge you a couple $100, they send you on your way, and you still have the same problem. So we have to do a couple things. We have to make sure, and most of the time, I will just replace the thermostats. If they haven't done that yet, we just replace the thermostats. They're not that expensive. Let's get that out of the way. then it usually comes down to really, really doing a good clean and flush internally on the radiator. And actually, I prefer that somebody good inspects the inside of the radiator and even see if it's salvageable. Sometimes it makes more sense to just put a new radiator in. But I don't want to do that. If this one's pretty good, it just needs a good cleaning. But then we also have to clean them on the outside. We've got to get the radiator and the charger cooler and the air conditioning condenser out of the truck, take them apart and clean them really good on the outside and inspect them for damaged fins. If you get enough damaged fins on that radiator, that will hurt the cooling a little. Then you get dirt in there. That hurts the coolant a little bit more. Then you get some buildup on the inside of the radiator. That hurts the cooling ability a little bit more. Then you get a thermostat that isn't responding as well as it used to because it's old. And you see how this can just build up to the point where it's just not working, but nobody can find anything wrong.
Okay. Okay. Well, can I go to the dealer for that or...
You can. I prefer a shop that you know and trust and really takes their time with things, because honestly, you could pull in and explain what I just explained to a lot of shops, and they're going to go, that guy on the radio is an idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. We'll find out what's wrong, and you see how that's working so far.
Right, a couple hundred bucks at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah. So. You know, it's not unusual for them to say, that guy on the radio, he's an idiot. He doesn't work on trucks every day. I do. But if you have somebody you trust and you explain them, they'll get it. I mean, this isn't rocket science. It's just, we see this all the time. I'm all out of time. I've got to get out of here. Thanks for joining me, and we'll see you back here next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work. And master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, we're going to go ahead and set up and do another hour here. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. Calls and we answer your questions about everything trucking, trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, buying and selling trucks and trailers. The list goes on and on. In fact, we go beyond just the business of trucking, and we talk about the lifestyle of trucking. We can talk about health and fitness issues, dealing with things on the road, whatever it might be. Give me a call. I'll do my best to tackle it and get you an answer. And if I don't have the answer, many times one of the listeners will help us out. And we are, these evening shows being just an hour, always short. So I'm not going to take any time. I'm just going to go right to the phone calls and see how many people we can help tonight. Let's head off to Missouri. Ricky, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin.
Hey.
I'm trying to get my taxes taken care of. And,
okay.
I've got my own authority and everything, and the tax preparer is telling me that when my wife rides with me, she does not get the claim per diem. Is this correct?
I don't think so. And the reason I say I don't think so is because you can read, all 70,000 pages of the IRS code and you won't find it addressed specifically. So we have to read what's in the code and try to apply it to your situation. Now, one of the things that I need to know is, do you ever show her as an owner of this? What is your business set up? Are you
sole proprietor?
Okay, so one of the things you can do. Now, again, we're going to get into a weird situation here. The IRS says that, and this is a change. For years and years, we filed husband and wife as a sole proprietor and split the Schedule C out. When we were done with it, we would split it out. Half of the profit would go to the husband. Half of the profit would go to the wife. We'd fill out Schedule SEs. Everybody would get credit for Social Security. And it was just a good way of doing it. A lot of benefits. Then the IRS came along and said, oh, no, wait a minute. You're going to have to file this as a partnership. And so we looked at it and we said, okay, what if we don't? What's going to happen if we just keep doing what we've been doing? And the worst case we could come up with was the IRS would come along sometime later and say, hey, wait a minute, you can't do this. You have to file a partnership. And at that point, we would file a partnership. Nothing would change because the dollars are all the same, whether it's a sole proprietor or a partnership, the tax doesn't change. And if the tax doesn't change, the IRS can't penalize us. So we said, hey, right. Why charge our clients to do a partnership return when we don't have to? Let's just do what we've been doing and wait and see what happens. And for years, I did it that way. The IRS never said a thing about it. Had they, we would have filed the partnership return, no harm, no foul, but they never did. So the first thing we have to do is you either have to get your accountant to do whatever they're comfortable with, but you want your wife as part of this business for several reasons. One, you have a much better payout in Social Security later on if both of you are paying in than if just one of you pays in. So that's one advantage to having her on the business. The other one, though, is the minute she's on the business, now she absolutely qualifies for per diem. It's her business. And when she travels for business, she gets to take a per diem deduction just like anybody else who owns a business. So I think that's why the accountant is saying no, because she's not being listed as a part of the business. So she doesn't have any income to take the per diem deduction against. And so I get it, but this is an easy fix. Just make her part of the business.
Yeah, we're getting ready to probably become an LLC and we'll each get paychecks and all that. So then it shouldn't be a problem then, right?
Absolutely not. Clearly, then any accountant who would tell you after that point she doesn't qualify, you need to fire. I understand
right.
why this hesitating, but the answer shouldn't have been she doesn't qualify. The answer should have been let's set it up so she does qualify, because that's a huge deduction. I mean, really big.
Yeah. Well, she doesn't travel with me all the time, but they were saying that the only way she could get a deduction is if she had a CDL and she was driving.
That is so wrong. I would love to hear their logic. I mean, put this in any other business, and how would that make any sense? If I own a business and I have to travel, I don't have to have a CDL just to take per diem. Per diem is not a driver thing. Per diem is a business deduction for anybody who travels for business. There are some different rules and different amounts, but even that, the IRS a couple years ago changed their wording. See, the IRS used to say that in order to get the better per diem, the kind that we use for drivers, you had to be subject to DOT hours of service. So the way we used to do it was if the spouse didn't have a CDL and didn't drive, we would just take the standard per diem for her. And then obviously the DOT per diem for the driver. But several years ago, I'm thinking it might even have been 5 or 6 now, they changed their wording. And the wording doesn't say anything about subject to DOT hours of service. Now what it says is works in the trucking industry. And actually, I think they use travel or transportation because trains, boats, all kinds of people get this. But they took that sentence out that said DOT hours of service, and it just says works in the industry. Well, she works in the industry.
Right. Yeah, she does all my back office work. And
exactly.
You know, whether she's on the truck or not, she's doing it. But
yeah, and when she's on the truck, I don't care if all she's doing is reading the map and telling you to turn right here. You know, she's working in the industry.
Right.
So it really comes down to, you know, reading the code, interpreting the code, and making sure that you literally read the code every year, because they change the wording on this stuff without really making a big deal out of it. You got to go read it all the time.
Right. So I'll bring that up to them about the working in the industry and see what they have to say about it.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? I just thought of this. I don't think I read the wording this year. And I'm hoping they didn't change it, but I'll go double check. Usually I try to do it around November because that's when they tend to change the per diem amounts. And I'm pretty sure I read it, but I'll go back and double check again.
I appreciate that. So, all right. Well, that's all I got. Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's see. We have time to squeeze one in this segment. Let's go to California. Stacy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Hey, I really need help. I went to Volvo. I have a Volvo 730, and we've been having trouble with the temperature inside.
Okay.
So it was either too cold or no heat, so we changed the heater core on both front and back. Okay, that took care of that. We started getting a smell and couldn't really get the temperature right. I went back and I let them know what my complaint was. So they said that they found out the actuator needed to be changed. So they changed it. And still having the problem of not getting the temperature at a comfort zone. In the sleeper, the front, the heater, I have to go all the way to the top last two notches in order to get good heat. I travel on the west, you know, the Rocky Mountains all the way to the west.
Okay.
I don't know if that has anything to do with it.
No, it shouldn't. And did anybody explain why they changed the heater cores, or it was just something to try?
The heater core, we asked because we had gone several times, and they kept telling me that they had done other work on it, and this is a used truck we bought about 5 months ago. So out of frustration, I guess, I just went and told them, you know what, just change the heater core. I wanted to change the temperature control module, I think it's what it was, and they told me it was actually the actuator that needed to be changed. So that's what we
did. Right. What year is this truck?
It's a 2011 730 Volvo.
Okay. Hold that thought. I'm going to get to a break. I'm going to bring you back on right after this break, and we'll try to figure this out. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
Unmute return.
Give me 1 second here. I gotta fix one more thing. Here we go. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Before the break, I was talking in California. I'm going to head back there. Stacy, the one thing I have to say is I've got a lot of experience with the earlier Volvos, but only up till about 2001. So 2011, there could be some features on that that I'm just not even aware of exist. Now, you have addressed the two areas that I would have looked at, you know, possibly a problem with the heater core and the actuator, but there are also some new electronics that I'm just not familiar with. One of the things, do you know if this truck has shut off valves for the hot water?
No, I don't, but they also changed the valve. So they told me something about having a blockage on the water line. So they did change those as well.
Yeah, there are shutoff valves, so in the summertime, you just close them off so hot water doesn't even go through the heater core at all. And those valves will either get clogged or somebody will close them or open them halfway, and it cuts down the flow, and that causes a problem. So you're saying they already replaced those as well. You have hit the three things that I know of. Now, the next place that I would start troubleshooting would be right at the dash controls themselves. And I have had some issues with the earlier Volvos, the dash controls just not working right. And the rheostat part of it just wears out prematurely, and you don't get good contact to show, you know, where it's supposed to be. That's where I would try next. And what I would do, if you can do it on the newer ones, is there's a way to just kind of bypass that and put full heat, kind of wire it directly and put full heat. And if you do that, it should literally just burn you out of there. It should be hot enough. And if that happens, then we kind of know it's that control itself. And the last time I had a problem with it, I didn't screw around. I just replaced that whole piece.
I will try that. One more thing. My tires, steer tires, this is the second set I buy, and they're wearing on the inside, on the right side. We already did an alignment.
Who did the Chinese tire alignment?
So I need to know what would you... Yes, we did. What would you recommend on the Michelin for me?
I don't recommend tires yet, because even with a cheap tire... when we see irregular, we have to first assume that there is an alignment problem. And the last thing we want to do is throw an expensive tire on there and ruin it. So we want to leave that cheap tire on as long as we can, as long as it's safe. You know, we're not pushing past limits. And if we wear this tire out to the point that it's not safe anymore and we still don't have the problem, I say throw a used tire on there until we figure it out. Because again, I don't want you to ruin a $100 steer tire. What kind of shop did the alignment?
TDS.
Not familiar with them. Did they put it up on some sort of a machine, a rack, and do it and show you a computer?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
Yes. TDS is the name of the company.
Okay. There are, you know, 15 reasons why that doesn't work. The first one is anytime we put it up on a rack system, we are trying to align the truck differently than the way it drives down the road. That's the first problem with those systems. Even though they're big and impressive looking and expensive, that's the first problem. That's not the way the truck is being driven down the road. So that align the truck sitting on the ground the way we drive it. The second one is, those machines need to be calibrated constantly, and I know these shops just don't do it. I've been to shops, I've studied this, they just don't calibrate those machines as often as they're supposed to. Some never do. The next part is, the kid that's running it or the guy that's running it, he may not have ever really been trained on how to truly align a truck. All he's been shown is you put it up here, you strap this down, you press this button, you wait to see what the computer says. Well, the computer isn't always right. In fact, if the computer says it's right, but the tire says it's wrong, then it's wrong. I mean, that's just the plain, simple truth. That computer can say whatever it wants, but if we have a wear issue, something's wrong. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean it's alignment, but there's a good chance that it is. Those are just some of the reasons why that, and it's so frustrating. People will say, I've had this truck aligned 4 times and I'm still wearing out tires. That tells us that the alignment is wrong. I don't care if we align it 40 times. If you get a wear pattern that indicates bad alignment, then it's just bad alignment. So this is why, again, we work with alignment. They align the truck on the ground in what's called the driven state. They adjust for wear in all the different components if they need to. Then they let the truck tell them whether it's aligned or not, not the computer. So they will take it. Now, this is a good MD alignment shop. Every single shop that does MD alignment does it right. Unfortunately, that's the real world. So that's why we like to go one step further and only work with MD alignment shops that we know and trust. If you get a chance and you are in Kansas City, I would take it to Chad Hone at Alignment Solutions. Guarantee you he will get it right. If Indianapolis, and I just drew a total blank on the name of the shop. God, I hate when I do that. But you can also call MD Alignment directly or go to their website, mdalign.com, and get a recommendation from them on where to go to get their method. Leave that cheap tire with the wear on the truck because that will help. A true alignment technician will look at the tire and know what the problem is. Now, after going through all that, it could just be a loose wheel bearing. But I lost the call, so I didn't have time to ask you a couple more questions. But that's okay, because if you get it to any one of these shops, as soon as they look at it, they'll say, oh, this isn't alignment. It's just a loose wheel bearing, and they'll fix it for you. Or they'll say, it's alignment. Or it could actually be both. But get to one of the MD alignment shops, call them, and they will take care of this for you. Let's see. Let's go to Kansas. Wes, welcome to the program.
Hello. You mentioned that your solar system was not working well in the wintertime, and it sounded to me like you might have a issue with your wiring as far as wire size. DC electricity travels on a wire different than AC electricity, and AC requires a much smaller wire than DC does.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And, you know, if you're buying, you know, some of the off-the-shelf components, and certainly I've seen some pretty cheap stuff out there, and that would be an issue. And that's a very good point, and it's something people should be aware of. This system really is, and I'm actually running two completely different systems, two panels, two controllers, two chargers, the whole shot, because we were testing different systems. We've played around with wire size. We've played around with panel size, with different controllers. So you're right. We have to make sure we have good panels, good wiring, good controllers. Once we do that, and I should have been more clear on that, then in my opinion, I'm always looking for more power, not less. You know, or not, I just can't get enough, especially when you get into the northern part of the country in the wintertime. For example, I'm in Oregon. You know, we don't get a lot of really sunny days, but even when we do, the sun is so low on the horizon, there's just not much energy coming from it.
Yeah. Another question, quick.
Yeah.
When you were on the health issue thing, when you were talking about fermenting vegetables, as an easier source to work with in the truck, would frozen vegetables work? Like, say, the cauliflower or like California blend, you know, it's got all the different vegetables in it.
Do you mean just for eating healthy vegetables or for the probiotic part?
For the probiotic part.
Oh, so take like frozen vegetables to start your ferment.
Yeah, instead I have to, you know, have a great big cutting board and can, you know.
That's a good question that I haven't seen it addressed directly in anything I've read, but what almost everybody that, you know, now there's the music. So let me get to a break and I will come right back and we'll talk about that. That's a good question. Stick around. Yeah, we go from fuel mileage to tires to heater issues to alignment to solar panels to fermented vegetables. I love my job. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to go right back to Wes in Kansas. So, Wes, here's what I have read is that people who ferment like to start with really fresh. They like to use organic. I get all that. If we're going to do this, you know, let's start with the best we can. But I also understand what you're saying. And I did this in that one time I was kind of in a hurry. And I wanted to ferment something, so I grabbed pre-shredded cabbage. So I didn't have to screw around with chopping it and coring it and doing it. It came out great. Frozen, we know, is a really good alternative to fresh because they pick it, they freeze it pretty quickly, so we don't lose really any nutrients. Sometimes frozen is actually more nutritious than fresh. If it takes a long time for a fresh vegetable to make its way to you, it loses more nutrition in that time, and frozen many times goes from the field to freezing within 8 and 10 hours sometimes. The one thing I would say, and this would just be a matter of experimentation, is that when you thaw a frozen vegetable, it already gets a little soft because the freezing breaks some of the cell walls, and then when we thaw it, it gets a little soft. That doesn't hurt anything, but when you ferment, it softens vegetables even more. So the only thing I would say is try it. It certainly can't hurt. It's going to work. And it's just a matter of, do you like, and if you do, then I think that's a great alternative.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of like cauliflower and I thought that would be a good place to try, but I'm going thinking about it. And I said, that's going to take a lot of space to work it down to a size I could get in a jar, you know?
Well, and here's the other possibility, because I just did this the other day, too. I bought a bag of pre-chopped cauliflower. It was fresh, but it was, like, pre-chopped already down to, you know, pretty good, the florette size, they call them. And that worked. That worked just fine. I didn't have to do any prep. I just threw it in the jar, poured my brine in, and I was done. But I may try some frozen. I'd never thought about it before. I may try it just to see how it works.
Yeah.
So give it a shot. You know, all we have to lose is 2 tablespoons of salt and 4 days. Not a big price to pay for a little bit of experimentation. Let's go to Louisiana. Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you today?
Doing good. What can I help you with?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment. Yesterday when we were coming across Texas, a few weeks ago you had talked about the crazy drivers a month ago, when you were on your way out to Ohio and how crazy truck drivers were. coming across Texas yesterday on 20, we got stuck in a little bit of a traffic jam. Okay, nothing unusual for out there. You know those service roads on the side of the, beside the interstate that you see
right
there in Texas? And
yep,
you always see the cars zip over in the little grassy area and run up on the service road so they don't have to sit in traffic, okay? Not a very safe thing to do, even in a car. But when you watch a semi do it,
wow,
it was terrifying. And it would have been different if it just would have been one semi, okay? It wasn't. I mean, it was three or four semis. And we were in this traffic jam for maybe 15 minutes.
Wow. Yeah, that's, you know, there's always been crazy drivers. There's always been bad truck drivers. But it just seemed to me like this time on the road, and again, I'm still on the road, and I'll be on the road probably till the end of May, beginning of June.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm just looking for it more. I don't know. But I see a lot of what I consider to be really lousy drive. Here's another one that I don't get. And I don't know if it's me because the unit I'm in is so unusual and it gets their attention. But all of a sudden, about half the trucks who pass me, which are a lot of trucks because I drive 57, I get passed a lot all day long. But about half the trucks that pass me, there must be some sort of a magnetic pull on my trailer. Because they're almost running, passing me, and then they have to swerve back over to the left. And then, for some crazy reason, they pull over and almost take the front of my truck off with their trailer. And I'm thinking, what is with this? It never used to happen this often. And, you know, do I have some sort of weird magnetic pull, or are they just staring at the trailer and, you know, you tend to drive where you look? I don't know what's going on.
I mean, we found, I mean, we do all 48 states, and we just found yesterday was just a prime example. I mean, we see an occasional bad driver, but yesterday in Texas, I mean, we're governed at 65, and they were flying past us like we were standing still. And I mean,
yeah, that I'm used
they
to.
Were,
I mean,
and you were talking about the magnet effect. I mean, they were doing the same thing with us and then cut right in front of us. And talk about a wind, and you feel that, like, you feel that pull when they cut in front of you like that.
You know, one of the issues that comes up once in a while, it would come up online and in the forums and that kind of stuff, with somebody, or I hear it on one of the other radio shows where the topic, they tend to talk, the other shows tend to talk a lot more about drivers, driver habits, bad stuff. I try to avoid it most of the time. It gets talked about enough everywhere else. But once in a while out here, you know, drivers don't have any courtesy anymore. Nobody flashes the lights to let you over. Well, I've that's a pet peeve of mine because we don't need to on the interstate. You know, that tradition, I grew up in this industry a long, long time ago. That tradition was a two-lane road when, you know, somebody that was passing you in a truck, you wanted to let them get back over as quick as they possibly could. So you would give them the lights, give them the chance to get back over. On the interstate, first of all, nobody waits long enough for me to give them the lights, even if I wanted to. They are over way more than I think they should be. We have two lanes. Take your time. I understand if you wait too long, sometimes a four-wheeler will try to shoot around on the right. I get that. But you still don't need to come over and leave me less than a half a truck length, you know, in between the two of us. And nobody would wait long enough for me to give them the lights anyway. And who needs to? On an interstate, by the time you're far enough past me to move over, you should know you're far enough past me.
Right, right. It just, it was just an unbelievable traveling day yesterday. I mean, even when we were out on the two-lane roads, okay, the trucks were passing us, and they were pushing us over to where we were on the shoulder of the road so they could get past us.
Yeah, now, you know, I will say when I'm out on two-lane and going 57, and if it happens to be a 65 zone on a two-lane and I see a truck coming up, And if it's safe and I've got the room, I will pull over onto the shoulder. I won't slow down really much, but I'll move over to the right so they have a clear line of sight and they know that, you know, I'm expecting them to come around me. And if they start to come around me and they're struggling a little bit, I'll back out of it a couple seconds. Doesn't hurt. And I do know passing on a two lane is much more difficult. And at 57, I don't want to be in a bunch of people's way on a two lane. Out on the interstate, I could care less. You've got another lane, you figure out a way around me. But on a two lane,
right,
I will tend to move over to the right, ride the shoulder and let them know, hey, it's come around me. You can see better. If I need to, I'll back out of it a little bit. And, you know, that doesn't happen that often. It's not a big deal. Again, you know, there have always been bad drivers. This issue gets covered over and over and over everywhere else. Once in a while, I guess I just feel the need to rant about it. But we'll move on to better stuff. We'll leave that for the others. Let's go to South Carolina. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing today?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, first I want to report on the very first ferment I did this past weekend.
Oh, yeah. How'd it go?
It actually went really well. I did a dozen mason jars, and I have to say I've been taste testing for the last couple of days, and some of the stuff I did I've already put in the refrigerator to kind of slow things down, and other stuff I'm leaving in the out and not refrigerating it yet. I want it to go ferment a little bit longer. But I wanted to point out a mistake that I made.
Okay.
And it was a silly mistake. I went and bought all the correct supplies. I've got sea salt and distilled water and mason jars and all that. And silly me, the first couple of ones that I did, for some stupid reason, I used tap water. And I wasn't even thinking of it until I was on to
that thought. I just heard the music, so I'm going to get to a break, and I will come right back. And I want to hear this, because the more people that do this, the more we share, the more we learn. Love it. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get right back to the calls. I was talking with John in South Carolina. John, go ahead. So use some tap water. What happened?
Well, I said, well, you know, I'd use the tap water. Screw it. I'll just, you know, go forward with it and see how it comes out.
Yeah.
And what
That's
I what found I over the next couple of days was that the ones with the tap water, and I have well water and I have pretty good well water at that.
Okay.
But
yeah.
It actually almost became carbonated.
Wow.
When I cracked the bottles, it fizzed.
That's
like
interesting.
A bottle of soda would. It was
very
interesting. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go for it and just continue fermenting and see what happens. And it has kind of an odd texture to the, I did carrots. Baby carrots.
Yeah.
And it has kind of an odd texture, and I kind of like it, you know, and I'm thinking, well, I guess it can't be bad.
No, it really can't. I mean, not bad in a way that could ever hurt you. And I think what can happen is the mineral content can change flavors and textures. And if it, see, that's the thing about this fermentation. Have you ever heard the phrase, and I've heard it used for things like golf and fly fishing and a couple other things, you know, an hour to learn, a lifetime to master.
Absolutely.
Meaning that, yeah, you know, you can pick up a golf club, start swinging at a ball, and you know, you can play golf. You can pick up a fly rod and start casting out into the water, and you're doing it. Doesn't take long, but you'll never really master either one of those games. Not or, or, you know, hobbies. Nobody's ever, you know, golfed a perfect game, and nobody ever catches a fish every time they cast. So it's always new. You're always learning. That's really the way this is. So simple. We've talked about how easy it is. You saw how easy it was. But the nuances and the, you know, different spices, different times, different temperatures, different vegetables, different ways to cut them. I mean, you could go on and on and on. And the mineral content of the water could change the way some of these things come out. So that's interesting.
And that was kind of just a throw in. I was really calling in because I wanted to give you a solution for your mounting for your GPS.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Yeah. The other day you had mentioned it on the show, and I have a great solution. Have you ever heard of a company called Bracketron?
No. Mm-mm.
Bracketron makes a bunch of little brackets to, like, hold your cell phones and such, like in your air vents. You know, they
oh, yeah.
kind of have, like, in-car, in-cab solutions for holding on to electronics. They make a product. It's basically a rubber mat that has a really sticky bottom to it, and it has a hard plastic disc in the middle of it. And I actually use that to hold my Rand McNally on my dashboard. And I have a T660, so it has a pretty steep part of the dashboard. And I tried a bunch of different ways to get that GPS to be mounted, because I don't like my GPS so far away from me. I got to lean forward to touch it. I want to just put my own hand up and touch it. I want everything at hand reach, the things that I'm going to be, you know, using when I'm driving.
Yeah.
And this product is awesome, because when the stickiness starts to go away, you just unmount it, run it under a little bit of water, dry it, and it gets super sticky all over again. It's a really cool product. They're not horribly expensive either, like $20-$25. And Bracketron is the name of the company that makes it.
I'll look for that, because I have found the perfect location on the Volvo, the dash. There's a pretty deep well right in front of me, and I can put it right there where I can see it right over the steering wheel. I can reach it easy, and it's not blocking my line. The only downside to that spot, and it's not a downside to me, I don't really use the dash cam. It because of the angle it puts it at, the dash cam really isn't looking out, but I don't use that, and I don't foresee myself using it. So I love this spot, but I just can't keep the damn suction cup on the window.
Yeah, I had that problem too. I'm sadly enough, I'm on my fourth Rand McNally in 4 years, and they haven't ever made a great bracket as far as I'm concerned. I think that's another one of their weak points. I mean, they weren't horrific, but they're not great either.
I love the magnet mount, and the way I've got it set up, mine won't drop off the magnet mount at all. It's never done that, but the suction cup just won't stay on the window, and it's the one thing that once I solve it, I'm going to be good, because everything else seems to be going great.
Well, I have one more Rand McNally question for you.
Sure.
You know, I have a couple of what I call doorstop Rand McNallys. They're dead. I mean, you can't even turn them on. They're worthless.
Right.
Are they doing any type of trade-in on those things to upgrade to a tablet, or you have no idea?
I have no idea. And I have those, and I've told the story many, many times. You know, the early one drove me nuts. So I've got a couple of those sitting around in a drawer too. And hey, what a difference from those when the hardware was just horrendous, in my opinion, to this one that now I'm so happy with. But, you know, if nothing else, I hate to throw that kind of stuff away. I'd at least like to recycle it or something.
I actually have a whole drawer full of useless electronics that I throw the stuff into. And I always joke around with my kids that one day we're going to go skeet shooting.
Yeah. Yeah, something. I mean, you know,
I'm going to get some use out of it, or I'm going to get some value out of it. And if that means that I'm going to shoot it with a shotgun, well, then I've gotten value out of it.
That's right. It'll be enjoyable.
Exactly. And then you pick up the pieces and recycle them.
Yeah, good stuff. Hey, I appreciate the heads up on that mounting. I am going to check that out. Let's see. Let's head off to Wisconsin. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. This is Jonathan. Now, I have one question. I've been having this problem with my truck with the start, and I bought the start module about a month ago. And every winter, sometime I go to start my truck, and it just click, click. Won't nothing happen. I mean, after I bought the start module, it out a little, but every now and then, it only does it in the winter.
Okay. So there's a couple things.
Nothing happens.
There's a couple things we have to look at when we have starting problems. Actually, several. The first thing we want to check is the voltage. Let's say you're getting that click, and whether you have an engine start module or not, just four batteries, you get that click. We need to check voltage, because if you go out there and it turns out your batteries are at, 13.6 volts, well, then it's not a battery issue. It's not a voltage issue. It's a starter issue or a solenoid or something in the electrical system as far as wiring, connections, grounds, something like that. But if we go out and check the voltage and we're at, 11.1, well, then, but even then it shouldn't click. It should turn very slowly. Now, if we get down under 10, then sometimes you won't even get a click. I mean, there's just not enough voltage to do anything. If the problem is voltage, the start module will fix it every time, because that start module will crank out, 15 volts and release it in a hurry. That's the whole point of the start module. So if you have a start module and you're still getting a click, it's not a voltage issue. It's probably a dead spot in the starter. Many times, you've got a brand new starter.
Put that on there about a year ago.
Brand new or rebuilt?
It was rebuilt.
Okay, two things. When did you get the start module?
About a month ago.
Okay, so when we get rebuilt, and there's nothing wrong with that. I buy rebuilt parts too, but I prefer new. When we get rebuilt, we never know the quality. I mean, one of the things, and I've been talking about it, for a couple of years now, is it seems to me we keep finding really, really poor quality rebuilds in all kinds of components. Alternators, starters, injectors, all kinds of things. So that could be an issue. But then we can also compound a weak starter with weak batteries. When we crank that starter with weak batteries or lower than optimal voltage, that really is hard on the starter itself. That's another benefit to the engine start module, is once we get the system working right, we've got a good quality starter, no solenoid problems, no wiring problems, and we use the engine start module, that starter will last much, much longer, because we don't have that low voltage drain happening anymore. So it sounds to me like you might kind of need to restart. You've got, no pun intended, you've got the start module, which is excellent. I think you're probably going to have to go with a new starter and then double check all your wiring, your grounds, your connections, clean them up, dielectric grease, all those good things we talk about. And that should eliminate these. And also check your alternator output just to make sure. Now, that shouldn't have any effect on starting now that you have the start module. I'm all out of time. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
Thanks for tuning in to The Audio Road. If you have any questions, give us a call at 855-800-FUEL. That's 855-800-3835. Check out the website at letstruck.com and find us on facebook.com/letstruck.